Good morning, everybody. Welcome. It's such a beautiful, cool, crisp spring day, isn't it? Yeah. So, that I was going to start with, I'm going to bookend my talk, which is called Who Is I? With two poems from Nagarjuna. And we're studying Nagarjuna in a morning study group right now, and Nagarjuna likes to deconstruct everything so that there's nothing much left to depend on. The first poem is called Already. Am I already here before I see and taste and feel? If not, how could I see, taste, and feel? How can I know if I'm already here or not? If I were here without them, they could be here without me. I reveal them and they reveal me. How can I be here without them? How can they be here without me? I am not already here before experience as such. Seeing reveals just the seer, tasting just the taster, feeling just the feeler. If I'm not already here before them all, could I be here before each one? Can the seer taste? Can the taster feel? Were they different, I would be legion. Nor am I tucked inside the elements when seeing and tasting and feeling unfold. If I, to whom these things belong, cannot be found, how can they be found? I do not precede them, nor am I with them, nor do I follow them. Let go of I am, let go of I am not. So, the idea for my talk this morning came from being at a retreat at Hokyoji with Dokai in the fall, in about September, and I think some of you were there. And one story that Dokai told was about when he was about 4 or 5 years old. He was a very inquisitive child, and he was incessantly asking his mother all kinds of questions. And then one day he asked his mother, "Where did I come from?" And his mother stopped in her tracks and looked at him. And perhaps she was thinking that he was asking him a sexual question. She didn't quite know what to say. And Dokai said that reflecting on this question he asked his mother when he was a child, he thought that he was asking her, "Where did I come from? Where did my identity come from?" And so, you know, I really was taken by that story and started pondering that question myself. It's, how do we create this I? We pile on layers of thought coverings that armor our true nature. You know, we say that the five aggregates, which are our senses and our mind, kind of help us create our world. What we perceive through our senses is what we are in some sense. The five aggregates are sometimes called the five heaps. And I say, heaps of what? Heaps of perceptions that we keep piling on from what we translate, what we take in through our senses. We're bombarded with information constantly, what we see and hear and feel, and we have to process it somehow. And how do we process it? As we accumulate all this stuff, we have to choose what to keep and what to let go of. What is the basis of the choices that we make? Do we make our choices based on greed, anger, and ignorance, which are we call the three poisons, or do we make our choices based on compassion and wisdom? Recently, I was talking to a woman who is a professional declutterer. And she was telling me that when we declutter, that we should first start with things we know we absolutely don't want and then progress from there. I saw a show, I'll admit it was an Oprah show, about hoarding once. And there was this woman on the show who was like this extreme hoarder in her household, and she went shopping for bargains all the time, and she just couldn't help herself. She didn't need the bargains, but she kept buying bargains and bringing them home, and she never returned anything, and her house was completely filled up with stuff. Absolutely, she couldn't move, that there was bags of clothes. She didn't even take the bags of the clothes out of the bag. You know, they were there with the receipts and stuff, and she just couldn't move in her house. And somehow her husband, you know, just watched this all happen, but felt helpless to stop it. And so when Oprah brought in the professional declutterer, I'll say, that he had some things to say about it. And he said that when somebody is a hoarder like that, that to start emptying out your house, you have to take a look at every item you're letting go of. You have to decide whether you're going to throw out the item, whether you're going to give away the item, whether you're going to sell the item, or whether you're going to keep the item. And if the person who isn't the hoarder isn't involved in this decision, that they're not going to be able to empty things out and will just go back to hoarding again. And I think that's a very apt metaphor for how we live our lives. What kind of stuff do we accumulate in our minds? What do we hold on to that creates this I that we say we are? What is it that we use for labels to describe ourselves? What is it that we want to convey to the world? What is it that we want to convey to ourselves? Who is I and what are we so attached to? In Buddhism, we talk about the idea of no fixed self. And what no fixed self means is that each moment is totally new and fresh. There's a constant arising and letting go of things. And so who I was when I walked in this room this morning might be kind of different from who I am at this moment. When I was walking in the room, I was a walker. When I'm here right now, I guess I'm a talker. You know, and each moment can be something different. That, you know, many of you know me. Oh, it's Susan talking in front of the room here today. And some of you don't know me. And so it's like, there's that woman talking in front of the room. Who is she, you know? And so I can put all kinds of labels on myself. I can put a label that I am a Zen priest in training. I could say I'm a mom. I could say I'm somebody's friend. I can say all kinds of things about myself. But, you know, each thing I might say about myself isn't completely the whole story. And maybe in some way there isn't a whole story. So, I think that each moment is like a jewel in Indra's net, And for those of you who don't know about Indra's net, at the intersection of every piece of netting, we say that there's a multifaceted jewel in Indra's net. And each multifaceted jewel reflects every other jewel in the whole universe. And so usually we use that term in relation to everything and all sentient beings, and I'd like to say that every moment is a jewel in Indra's net, and that every moment that has been and is right now and will be in the future is all reflected in every jewel that we see and in every moment we experience. On the other hand, each moment is also distinct in and of itself. Everything is in a constant state of creation. Although the circumstances and environment might seem familiar, each moment is fresh. If we can accept our lives as being fluid, there is a possibility of some kind of contentment. When we don't get stuck in this idea of I, we can have some freedom from suffering, from our attachment and our grasping to what we think we are and moments we've experienced. Because oftentimes, when we have a happy time, we don't want to let go of it. We want to hold on to it and not let it go and feel like we want the moment to last forever, but unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. So in Norm Fisher's book, that's called Sailing Home, he's talking about, he's looking at Homer's Odyssey in a spiritual context. And there's a chapter in Sailing Home called Waiting. And in it, he's talking about Odysseus's son, Telemachus, who was 20 years old at the beginning of the Odyssey, and his father had been gone for 10 years going and fighting in Troy. Oh, I guess his father had been gone for 20 years, and so he had left when Telemachus was a baby, or maybe even not. I guess he was born, but he left soon after he was born. And so he didn't have a big picture of who his father was, that his father had been fighting in Troy for 10 years, and then it had taken him 10 years to get back home after the war was over. And so Telemachus was in this household with his mother, and in the household there were people swarming, suitors who wanted her hand in marriage, who wanted to have everything that was in Odysseus's home. So Penelope, his mother, would crochet or sew something during the day or knit something, and at night she was unraveling it, because supposedly when she had finished this shawl for her father-in-law, I guess, that she had to pick a suitor. And she was stuck, and she didn't want to move on from being with Odysseus, although he had been gone for so long. And so she was stuck. Nobody knew whether Odysseus was alive or dead. And so Telemachus was stuck with his mother. All these people were in their household eating their food and using up all the goods that were in their home. And the goddess Athena came to kind of give Telemachus a push and say, okay, you're entering manhood now. It's time for you to get going and to get moving and not be stuck anymore. And so Telemachus, with the urging of Athena, who he didn't know as Athena, she was kind of a shapeshifter, and she came as a fellow named Mentor. He set sail to look for his father and to try to answer questions about where his father had been. And it was, he had to, so to speak, step off the 100-foot high pole, which is another little thing, expression from Zen Buddhism. When we step off the 100-foot high pole, we don't know where we will land or how we will land, but we have to have the faith to just take that step without knowing what will be. So Telemachus set sail not knowing where his journey would take him. So he didn't know quite who he was. He had to discover who he was and find out where his father had been. Recently I had taken a couple month break from Zen Center, that I felt I had to ponder who I was and the box that I had created and had been created around me, that I couldn't find my way out of the box without taking myself away from here for a few months. I was really stuck. I kind of needed some time to deconstruct all the layers of stuff that were accumulating around me. I kind of needed to set sail and be on my own journey. I needed to let go of this idea of who I am and who I was, and kind of see who I could be without being in the middle of things here. That I had been the temple coordinator, which was kind of a big job around here. And I just needed to walk away and let it go and see where I landed and have some time to discover who I was or who I wasn't, and have some space and time to do that, and to have more time at home with my family, and to do things away from here that I hadn't done for quite a while. While I was gone, I was in contact with Tim. I met with Tim every couple weeks, and Tim is the person who's the head teacher here. And sometimes we emailed each other. And some of you have heard this, but some of you haven't. I was getting kind of nervous about what my place would be here, or what spot I would have when I came back here. And here is part of that email. And I said, "What's making me nervous is that I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do when I return in January. I've got no particular temple officer job and no class to teach until summer, perhaps." And Tim's response: "You might ask what it would be like not to have a place for yourself at all. Not to have a place for yourself at all at Zen Center or anywhere else. Does Susan need a place, a spot at the table to be Susan? Does Buddha need a spot at the table to be Buddha? If Susan is Buddha, do they both need spots, or can they share a spot? Without spots, what will happen to them? Will they feel unloved, unappreciated, and just shrivel up and die? If they both shrivel up and died, what would that be the end of everything? What if Tim, Susan, and Buddha all ended at this very moment? Would they be dead, or would they be more fully alive? See you tomorrow, Tim." And this little email, I feel, was the best thing Tim has ever communicated to me since I have been his student, and I think of it often. I think about the idea of, what if we don't have a spot? I mean, what is this, the big deal about having a spot at the table? You know, it's like, why do we need a spot at the table? You know, and although we all think we do, what would happen? What would happen? And I've been feeling like without having a spot at the table or an important spot at the table, that I find a lot of spaciousness in that. That later on, before I was coming back, Tim said, I want you to come back like a mouse. And I was like, my first thought was, a mouse? What do you mean a mouse? And so, but then I kind of thought about being a mouse. I said, oh, a mouse, that's pretty good. You know, that I don't have to, I'm not expected to be anything particular. That nobody needs to count on me for being in any particular role or job, or just to be here and to be myself and to be helpful and however I can be helpful. So that not knowing what to expect from moment to moment, kind of this idea of groundlessness, that we take a step and we take a step and we don't necessarily know what the next step will bring us. We don't know what will arise in the next moment. That a good friend of many of ours, her husband recently had a stroke. And, you know, when somebody falls ill or something unexpected happens, how do you respond to that? How can you engage with the thing that everything has changed, that perhaps the rug underneath you has been pulled out? Can you still take a step? Can we still meet what's coming up in front of us, that it isn't familiar at all? And, you know, and in that as well, we have to hope that our Sangha and our community and our friends kind of rise up to help support us in this moment of groundlessness. So, Katagiri Roshi talks a little bit about having no particular labels in his book, Returning to Silence. He had a young man staying with him who was asking him lots of questions, and he was kind of tired, but he finally was answering this young man's questions. He said, I am a Soto Zen priest, but I am not talking about Soto Zen. I am talking about Buddhism, because Buddhism is learning human life. So strictly speaking, I am talking about human life, the original nature of human life, the taking off of lots of cultural clothes. Whatever it is, take it off. Then what is left? Just a human being. I wanted to say a little bit more about how we conceptualize and characterize ourselves, that I've been looking at this, that, you know, when we meet somebody new who doesn't know anything about us, what do we say when they ask about you? Do they, you talk about your job? Do you talk about, you know, what you're doing that day? Do you say something about who you are as a person? What is it that you say to describe yourself? Am I a PhD? Am I a head teacher, abbot at a Zen center? Am I a garbage person? What am I? You know, and none of those things actually hit the mark. And how do we label ourselves? And how can we let go of those labels? What is it that's more essential in who we are? You know, that am I a person who just likes to smile, which is somebody I might describe myself that way, or an optimist, or I've been around MZMC since 1980, and I was a student of Katagiri Roshi's. Look at me, or am I a student of Tim's, or am I just somebody here walking around and trying to do the best I can, and what's happening right now? That I think we often get stuck in the boxes we create for ourselves, that maybe I think of myself, I'm this person who is from New York and I'm a pushy New Yorker. And people, maybe I put myself in that box and maybe other people put me in that box. And so how can I climb out of the box and how can other people allow me to climb out of the box? And I think it's really important to be able to see ourselves anew in every moment and to give the people around us the chance to be something different and to just not label somebody from what you've experienced from them before. Maybe somebody's grouchy one day and he's like, and they're not treating you well. Can you look beyond them not treating you well and say, I wonder what's going on with this person? Why is this person grouchy? Something else, maybe something happened to them today that is making them sad or making them grouchy. And to give people the space to be different in every moment, but also giving ourselves that same space and being able to love ourselves and other people however they are. That I was wanting to tell a story that actually Will told this story a couple of years ago at a practice period, that he was talking about a coworker of his who people had characterized as kind of a bit of a pain in the neck. And so I believe that Will works at the help desk or something like that. This person was calling Will like every 5 minutes to get some advice on different things. And so that instead of, Will made this decision that instead of being annoyed every time this person called, he started feeling like every time this person calls, I'm going to just regard it as a new fresh phone call, not worrying about if he's ever called before, and just seeing this person in a new way every 5 minutes. And I was really... A what? Oh, every 30 seconds! Oh! So can you do that? Every 30 seconds? It's kind of like... It's like, oh, what's this guy want already? I was like, who are you? Or whatever. And I've kept that story with me because it really impressed me. And let's see. I was also just wanting to talk about, making assumptions about somebody else. That I have a story about my father and my father-in-law. That if you look at who these men were, because they're both gone now, but who these men were, my father was this nice Jewish, Zionist Jewish guy from New York. Kind of a very verbal kind of guy and this and that. And my father-in-law was this fundamentalist Christian from central Minnesota. But how could these people get to know each other? I think that when they first met each other, there was a lot of fear there. I know when I first met my in-laws, there was fear there. And I'm sure they were a little bit scared of me too, because we didn't know each other. We looked at each other's labels and were insecure about what the other person would think of us, and our ideas about who that other person is. And throughout the years, my father and my father-in-law got to know each other really well. You know, that Dwayne and I have been married 22 years now, but our fathers have been gone about 4 years now. But throughout the years, they got to know each other well. And like when my mother died, my father-in-law would call my father on the phone to see how he was. And they got to be really good friends, this fundamentalist Christian and this Zionist Jew. And they were kind of close to the end that they died within about 6 months of each other. But I'm always impressed thinking about, you know, when we can let go of our ideas about how somebody else is, or how something else is, how the connection can be made. And, you know, when we can allow all these layers of thought coverings to drop off, how the connections with an engagement with other people and our environment happens. When we realize that there's no fixed self, that I, along with everybody and everything, is a work in progress, we engage in life with a lot of spaciousness. So I wanted to end with another poem from Nagarjuna. This one is called Life. Is life what drives me, whether constant or fleeting? Drives are not alive like life. How am I alive when I cannot be found inside this mind or body? Who is there to be alive? If I survive by clinging on to thoughts and feelings, how could I evolve? Without clinging or evolving, who can be alive? If I came and went, how could I be freed? If clinging binds, I who cling would be unbound, like those who do not cling. How is it I am trapped? Neither bound nor unbound are free. Were the bound to be freed, freedom and bondage would be simultaneous. I am free. I cling no more. Liberation is mine. Mine. The greatest clinging is to cling like this. What do you think of a freedom that never happens? What do you make of a life that won't go away? So, if anyone has any comments or questions or vignettes or anything, please.
Also, Matt, I really like your talk.
Thank you.
Really, what you call it, brought up today.
Thanks. Okay, great.
When Katagiri was here, we had an infestation of mice, and I don't know if people remember. And so we sit facing the wall, and you're supposed to keep your eyes just slightly open, and you'd see this blur go by. And, you know, mice run along the board of the wall. And so the reason I mention it is, besides Susan talked about a mouse, was the fact that what do you do with mice in the Zen Center? You know, maybe you don't poison them, you know what I mean? You don't put them in one of these dreadful traps. And I always remember looking back, it was just a great time that people got together to decide how do you live trap a mouse and move them over to your neighbor's property?
Does that mean you tried to get rid of me, guys?
That was just a great moment.
So how did it work out?
Well, it worked out fine.
Well, actually, the Katagiris used to borrow my cat.
Oh, you're a good neighbor.
And the cat had no teeth, and it just grabbed him with its gums.
I don't know. There was one time that Roshi closed the door to their living quarters upstairs, and my cat was wandering around down here. And do you know what she did? She peed on his donkey cart. Nobody else knows.
Could you say a little bit about how we should understand I in the contemporary world where, you know, that typical question. You know, we all have social security numbers, we have property taxes, and it identifies us as I. So how do we separate those two visions of I?
You know, I think that, you know, in the relative world where we have to live, having an I, an identity, and an ego, and a way to be living our lives and having a container for our lives, you know, that we all need that. But I think that we need to also not get caught by it, you know. So what I would say to you is, yes, you're a college professor, and you're a Zen student, and you live upstairs, and your husband, and this and that. But it's important to have all those different roles, but it's also important to know that there's something beyond all these different roles you play, that, so that you don't get too caught by it.
Guy, I think she's trying to tell you you're nothing.
At something, if it's anything. You can be a mouse with me.
Yeah, I am a mouse.
So the search for the true self, is it a giving up of these layers, these roles, or is it like the classic statement of there's a tree, and then later it isn't a tree, and then later it's a tree again? But I've heard it like that. I always thought when I read about, you know, where's the mind, where, you know, where were you before you were born, that kind of thing, it seems to me a rejection of, you know, the more trivial aspects of a personality and the role of parent and friend and worker. And I always wondered how that was resolved, because of course if you're a Buddhist or a monk full time and you're living in a profound silence and so forth, well, you don't really have a personality in the normal American sense of, you know, everyday life. I never was a monk every day, so I'm sorry if I insulted anybody here. But anyway, that's the question I have is, at the end of the search for the true self, you know, are you still a mother? Are you still a co-worker? Are you still a friend? Have these roles?
I think it's important to recognize what the layers are. To say I'm a mother, or I'm a priest, or I'm an ad salesperson, or this or that. You know, I do all these different things, but I know what they are, and in some way recognize them, and being able to let go of those layers if the circumstance needs that, you know, is to not hold too tight. Does that make sense?
There is no end to the self for true selves. There is not. There is no end to the search for true self. The search itself is the end.
And it's kind of like my saying that we're always a work in progress.
I think what happened in a monastery setting, in a very long retreat, when all of these things are taken away or set aside, and you simplify, 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 then get to see all the other layers. Oh, I'm the one that brings the teacher the cup of water. You know, then you're that person. It just, it's like Jeff said, it just can go on and on and on and on forever. Which is one of the reasons why there's some very positive attention given to simplifying your life. And because then you can see all the
so it's not to see those roles as roles, but then eliminating them. As opposed to eliminating them.
Yeah, I think it's impossible to eliminate them. You know, it's kind of like if we're here on a long retreat, while we're here, we can really simplify. But then we leave here and we have to take on some of those roles again. And how is it, what do we do when we have to put those clothes back